the sort of key lesson of the Teapot Dump Scandal for special prosecutors today is the importance of democratic politics, the fact that the American people re-elected large Republican majorities to both houses of Congress and re-elected Calvin Coolidge in 1924, despite the cloud of scandal over the Republican Party and the Coolidge administration at the time, was a really big impediment to the ability of the special prosecutors to follow these charges to their logical conclusion. The other really important takeaway here is the importance of political norms, widespread, widely shared standards for presidential conduct, which enabled the American people, have at various subsequent points in American history, enabled the people, American people, to make judgments and hold the president accountable for misconduct, even if it might happen to be a president that they like.
I'm Michaela Fogel, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 12, 2019. As the nation braces for the forthcoming end of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation into President Trump and his associates, the Lawfare Podcast decided to take a look back at the complete history of special prosecutors. Benjamin Wittes sat down with Andrew Cohn, a professor of law at the James E. Rogers College of Law at the University of Arizona. Cohn recently published Prosecuting the President, which traces the history of how special prosecutors and counsels work to keep the executive branch accountable for its actions. Ben and Andrew discussed the book, The Teapot Dome Scandal, The Whiskey Ring, and what all of that might mean for the future of special counsels. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 399, Andrew Cohn on Prosecuting the President.
So let's start with a big, broad question. How did you come to be writing such a timely book about whether and under what circumstances one can investigate and prosecute the President of the United States?
I wrote the book because everyone that I knew, not just my law professor friends, but my family and my friends who were not involved in the law in any way, were really desperate to understand how special prosecutors work. And in particular, they were puzzled by two questions. How could officials who seem so weak on paper have forced one president, Richard Nixon, from office and nearly forced another, Bill Clinton, from office and triggered impeachment proceedings in his case? And how could Robert Mueller have stuck around as long as he has when the president has the power to fire him at any time? And then second, how have we as a country come to entrust this awesome power of holding the most powerful man in the world accountable to such a subordinate official? So I really wanted to get my head around these questions, and I had some initial ideas about what the answers might be, but I was eager to learn more, and I decided the best way to do that would be to write a book.
So let's talk about the history to start. Do you agree with me that the idea of a special prosecutor investigating the president would have been unthinkable to the founding generation?
I haven't dug deeply into the founding era history, so I hesitate to express a really strong view on that question. I think it's an issue that, as far as I know, the founding generation hadn't thought all of that deeply or carefully about. I do think there's reason to believe that the founding generation, at least many members of it, would have been shocked at the idea of a sitting president being charged with a crime. Most of my focus in the book and in my research covered the era after the appointment, and including the appointment of the first special prosecutor in U.S. history by Ulysses S. Grant in 1875.
Right. So we're going to come to the whiskey ring in a moment. But I am struck in thinking about this history by the fact that, you know, we talk about the first special prosecutor and then the Teapot Dome prosecutors and, you know, some other investigations that happened along the way. But what is striking to me is that until Watergate, none of these investigations are investigations of the president himself. They're all investigations. I mean, the whiskey ring, which we'll talk about in a moment, is investigation of corruption up to and including the president's personal secretary. But the idea of the investigation being an investigation of the president is a graft onto the idea of the special prosecutor that's actually develops pretty late. Is that right?
I think it's right, although with a caveat. Many of the allegations that the earlier special prosecutors were appointed to investigate had cast a pall of scandal over presidents themselves, even though the charges that those special prosecutors were originally appointed to investigate were not specifically against the president. And Grant himself had his reputation tarnished in part by his handling of the charges against members of his administration. And that's, in fact, the way that many of the later scandals involving presidents actually evolved as well. I mean, Watergate sort of falls into that same pattern.
All right, let's talk about the Whiskey Ring. The Whiskey Ring scandal is not merely the first appointment of a special prosecutor. It is also the first time a president fired a special prosecutor or had one fired. It is also the first time the president's testimony is demanded and gotten in a criminal proceeding. It's a remarkable event, largely forgotten in a lot of history. So how did Ulysses S. Grant come to tolerate the appointment of Mr. Henderson as a special prosecutor? And what were the circumstances, and what was the lasting institutional effect that was created here?
The St. Louis Whiskey Ring is an incredibly juicy historical episode, one which ought to be included in more history books and taught in more eighth grade civics classes and high school history classes, because it was both a significant episode at the time and one that had lasting institutional impacts. It started as a kickback scheme involving hundreds of federal revenue agents throughout the Midwest. It was called a ring because it encompassed a ring of Midwestern cities, including St. Louis and Peoria and Milwaukee. And at the time, the federal whiskey tax was one of the main sources of federal revenue, and it therefore provided a rich potential target for corruption. And that's exactly what it became in this case. The revenue agents basically struck a deal with distilleries to underreport their whiskey production, saving them millions of dollars in federal taxes, which the distillers then split with the federal revenue agents. This ring reached all the way into Grant's inner circle in the person of Orville Babcock, who is a kind of wonderful dramatic figure. He was a kind of protege to Grant during his Civil War days, served on Grant's staff, and actually reached the rank of general in the Union Army himself. And then Grant brought him on to the White House when he was elected president after the war. He served as Grant's personal secretary, which doesn't sound like a very important title today, but that was the term that was used at the time to refer to the person who basically performed the functions that the White House chief of staff performs today. So he was quite a central figure in the Grant administration, quite beloved by the president, who saw him as a protege and who was really taken in by his wiles. Many historians have compared him to the villain of Shakespeare's Othello, Iago, because he was such an insidious figure and so good at conniving and persuading even genuinely people, you know, persons of integrity, as Grant himself was, to go along with and further his own nefarious schemes. And Babcock was deeply involved in the Whiskey Ring, came under suspicion, and as a result of the suspicion that attached to Babcock and other members of the Grant administration, other Grant appointees throughout the Midwest, Grant began to face very substantial pressure to appoint a credible investigator, or to run at least a credible, independent, and impartial investigation. And so finally, he agreed under pressure to appoint former Missouri Senator John Henderson to serve as a special prosecutor, the first one in U.S. history. The record, unfortunately, on exactly how these internal deliberations focused on the idea of a special prosecutor, how this idea came to be, are unfortunately sparse. I've dug as deeply as I could into the historical record here, and the particulars are unfortunately pretty vague, but this much is clear, that Grant was facing really significant political pressure to signal that he was serious about getting to the bottom of this scandal, but he wasn't personally involved in this scandal. And the solution that he and his advisors came up with was to appoint a figure of well-known national reputation and a well-known reputation for inflexible integrity. John Henderson actually was an interesting guy himself. He had cast the deciding vote against Andrew Johnson's impeachment in the United States Senate just a few years earlier. Johnson, of course, was Abraham Lincoln's Democratic vice president who assumed the presidency after Lincoln's assassination and was much loathed among Republicans. Henderson himself, like Grant, was a Republican. He established a kind of national reputation for going his own way and voting his conscience by voting against conviction in the Senate in the Johnson impeachment proceedings. And that did not win him many friends among the Republican Party, but it made him a good choice for Grant as a vehicle for signaling that he was really serious about getting to the bottom of these charges. And he, in fact, issued a memorable directive at the time that he appointed Henderson as the first special prosecutor in his history. And that directive was to let no guilty man escape. Quickly, Grant became persuaded by members of his inner circle, including Babcock, that the Henderson investigation was simply another partisan attack on his administration. And the Republican media at the time, which was very robust, engaged in a series of sustained attacks on Henderson's investigation, which helped to foment this idea in Grant's head that Henderson really was a partisan, out-of-control investigator. And finally, Henderson made an indiscreet remark in his closing argument in the trial of one of the lower-level Whiskey Ring conspirators, suggesting that Grant himself was potentially involved in the investigation for which no evidence, or in the scandal, rather, in the corruption, for which no evidence has actually emerged. And this was the last straw for Grant, and he fired Henderson. Now, this firing took place at a really crucial time. It was right on the eve of Orville Babcock's trial for bribery. Babcock was the most important figure implicated in the Whiskey Ring scandal, the one who was most closely associated with the president. And so it looked pretty bad for the president to fire the special prosecutor just a month before Babcock's trial. And this really damaged the prosecution of Babcock badly. Grant did appoint a second special prosecutor, but when the heat again began to rise for Orville Babcock, Babcock persuaded Grant to testify as a character witness on his behalf, which resulted in his immediate acquittal, nearly immediate acquittal by a St. Louis jury. So this was not a case in which the president was compelled to testify by a special prosecutor, in which a special prosecutor actually sought the president's testimony. It was a case in which the defendant, in a case being investigated by a special prosecutor, sought the friendly testimony of a president.
Over the next 100 years, between then and Watergate, there are a number of other special prosecutors who crop up. The most famous of them is the Teapot Dome duo. But talk us through who else, you know, by the time Archibald Cox is appointed, there's a bit of a tradition of this that begins with Henderson. But what does the tradition look like by that point?
Between 1875, when Grant appoints the first special prosecutor, and 1973, when Elliot Richardson appoints Archibald Cox as the first Watergate special prosecutor, several presidents of both major political parties have appointed special prosecutors to investigate allegations of misconduct or lawbreaking within their administrations. As you point out, Teapot Dome is probably the most important of those, and certainly the most colorful and interesting of those episodes. It began as perhaps the most audacious corruption scandals in U.S. history. In the early 1920s, this group of ambitious and unscrupulous royal barons got together and literally bought the Republican presidential nomination for Warren Harding. In exchange, Harding's campaign manager promised to sign over the drilling rights to several spectacularly rich federal oil reserves, including one called Teapot Dome, which eventually gave the scandal its name. The dirty work eventually fell to Secretary of the Interior Albert Fall. Albert Fall was a really interesting and distinctively shady kind of a character. He was really a relic of the Old West. He was a veteran of the same Lincoln County Range Wars in New Mexico that produced Billy the Kid. He would have fit in nicely at the OK Corral. He was known to carry a revolver even as cabinet secretary. And early in Harding's administration, Fall signed over the oil rights to several federal oil reserves worth, in today's dollars, several billion dollars in exchange for bribes of roughly a few million dollars. And he eventually came under suspicion. There was a Senate investigation which turned up testimony that made it look quite a bit like Albert Fall had taken a bribe, which in fact he had. This triggered a special prosecutor investigation. By this time, Harding had died of a heart attack, so it was really his vice president and successor, Calvin Coolidge, who had to face the music. And Coolidge shrewdly moved to manage this scandal by immediately calling for the appointment, not of one special prosecutor, but two special prosecutors, one from each major political party to give the investigation a bipartisan cast and to signal his own seriousness about getting to the bottom of the investigation. But these two special prosecutors, like many throughout U.S. history, faced a really uphill battle in investigating the close associates, the inner circle of Republican presidential administration, of any presidential administration, happened to be Republican administration in this particular case. Their job was made that much more difficult by the fact that Republicans swept the 1924 elections, retaining control of the White House and winning large majorities in both houses of Congress, which at various points actually cut off the funding for the special prosecutor investigation. And the two special prosecutors, Owen Roberts and Atlee Pomeraney, actually had to fund the investigation out of their own pockets at various points. The special prosecutors did win some important victories. They, perhaps most importantly, won the cancellation of the federal oil leases, which had been obtained by Sinclair and Doheny in exchange for federal bribes, restoring billions of dollars of oil wealth to the American people. They also won some relatively modest convictions against Fall and Sinclair for bribery and jury tampering, respectively. Edward Doheny got off, was acquitted of bribery charges on the pretense that the money that he had paid to Albert Fall was a loan. But this was really just scratching the surface of what was an incredibly robust, elaborate, and far-reaching corruption scheme involving many of the most important politicians and businessmen in the United States at the time.
Although not Harding himself, right?
As far as we know, not Harding himself. That's right. Harding himself was kind of a figurehead president. The real brains behind his campaign and his administration, as long as it lasted, was Harry Doherty, his wily campaign manager and later attorney general, who was also involved in a whole bunch of other unrelated corruption. I think that the sort of key lesson of the Teapot Dome scandal for special prosecutors today is the importance of Democratic politics, the fact that the American people reelected large Republican majorities to both houses of Congress and reelected Calvin Coolidge in 1924, despite the cloud of scandal over the Republican Party and the Coolidge administration at the time, was a really big impediment to the ability of the special prosecutors to follow these charges to their logical conclusion. The other really important takeaway here is the importance of political norms, widespread, widely shared standards for presidential conduct, which enabled the American people, have at various subsequent points in American history, enabled the people, American people, to make judgments and hold the president accountable for misconduct, even if it might happen to be a president that they like, whose policies they like. Those norms were much less robust at the time of Teapot Dome than they were at the time of the Watergate investigation.
All right. So there are a couple of other features of the Teapot Dome investigation that I think are interesting. One is the choice of selection mechanism of the special prosecutors, which was to pass a law saying we're going to have some special prosecutors and the president is going to name them and it's going to be by advice and consent of the Senate. So you have this very weird mechanism of an individual statute creating the individual appointments and them being presidential appointees rather than, for example, named by the attorney general as Bob Mueller or Archibald Cox was, or named by the special court as people were under the old independent counsel law. The second interesting element is this very odd decision to have two of them. And to have them be from diverse parties. Owen Roberts, of course, goes on to become a Supreme Court justice. Neither of these mechanisms, both of which seems to me to have some considerable amount to recommend them, to be candid, have been repeated over time. I'm interested for your thoughts on why, given that it was ultimately a pretty successful investigation, and, you know, Teapot Dome until Watergate was the sort of prototypical corruption scandal. Why did this model not catch on?
In part, I think it's because the statute was written as a one-off to deal with a particular situation rather than establishing a kind of ongoing institutional framework like the Ethics of Government Act did in 1978. That, of course, is the law which created the independent counsel, which existed for 20 years, from 1978 till the end, essentially, of the Bill Clinton impeachment proceedings. Another reason is that the types of scandals that have given rise to public calls for special prosecutors only come along so often, and that in the absence of any kind of well-established institutional framework with an enduring existence over time, there's a sense in which any president or any attorney general facing political pressure to appoint an outside investigator of some kind is put in the position of reinventing the wheel. There is also probably one other important factor explaining this, which is that special prosecutors appointed by statute who have gone through the Senate confirmation process and are appointed by the president have a kind of public stature and a kind of congressional buy-in and investment that subsequent presidents who face calls for special prosecutors, in fact, eager to avoid if they could get away with it, which every president who has since faced the situation seems to have been able to do.
Between Teapot Dome and Watergate, a lot of the stories kind of have a big gap in those, you know, 40 years. There were other special prosecutors appointed in that period. So what's the sort of interstitial history between Pomerani and Owen Roberts and Leon Jaworski and Archibald Cox?
There were some independent investigators appointed during World War II to investigate mismanagement of military appropriations, but they don't really fit the conventional definition of a special prosecutor. One official who does fit that definition appointed between Teapot Dome, certainly the most significant example of such an official is Newbold Morris, who was appointed to investigate corruption scandals in the tax division of the Justice Department and the Federal Bureau of Revenue, which is the predecessor to the modern Internal Revenue Service. These were relatively low-level corruption scandals. They involved mid-level and low-level officials charged with collecting federal taxes, shaking down individual tax owners, often small business owners, for small payouts or favors in exchange for tax forbearance. All this was happening mostly under the auspices of the Department of Justice, which was headed at the time by Harry Truman's close political ally, Howard McGrath. He was clearly a politically connected guy and had made his reputation as a political operator rather than an apolitical Justice Department lawyer. And the political pressure began to build towards the end of Harry Truman's second term to undertake some kind of serious independent investigation of these corruption allegations, which had proliferated near the end of Truman's term. And Truman initially was a little bit tone deaf in his response, and he announced that McGrath himself would run a serious internal investigation. This predictably did very little to mollify the critics of the administration, because McGrath himself was seen as part of the problem and potentially someone who might be personally involved in the corruption. And the blowback to this announcement was significant, and under pressure, Truman agreed to accede to the appointment of a special prosecutor. He charged McGrath with finding one, and he found Newbold Morris. Morris seemed like a good fit for the appointment because he had a reputation as an anti-corruption crusader in New York City politics. But he turns out to have actually been quite a bad fit for the job. He was someone who had actively cultivated a reputation as a sort of morally upright, clean government politician who had very little aptitude for and perhaps little appetite for actually following through on those commitments and getting to the bottom of a serious situation that was facing both the Bureau of Revenue and the Justice Department. And as a result, he was easily outfoxed by the internal bureaucratic operators who were responsible for the corruption in the Truman Justice Department and Bureau of Revenue. And he quickly made a series of enemies, most notably by distributing an extremely extensive financial questionnaire to a huge number of Justice Department employees, including Howard McGrath himself. McGrath outright refused to sign the questionnaire, to answer the questions posed to him by McGrath, and fired him as a result. Immediately, Truman fired McGrath. The circumstances here, again, are a little bit murky. Most people inside the Truman administration seem to agree that Morris was ineffective, that the president was legitimately interested in getting to the bottom of these bribery scandals in the Justice Department, but that he had chosen or had allowed his attorney general to choose a really bad man for the job. At the same time, McGrath was not cooperative, made lots of efforts, apparently, to stymie the investigation, and Truman didn't feel like he could allow McGrath to fire Morris without getting rid of McGrath himself and wiping the slate clean. So the investigation ended sort of inconclusively. There was ultimately no significant accountability for the various mid and low-level officials who seem to have been most heavily involved. On the other hand, the Attorney General, under whose watch all of these various misdeeds took place, himself lost his job at the end of the day. And these mixed results are probably partly a product of the ineptitude of the special prosecutor in this case. They're partly a product of the incentives that McGrath had to find a special prosecutor who could present a credible image to the public as someone who was really going to be committed to getting to the bottom of the corruption in the Justice Department, but would actually be ineffective behind the scene. At the end of the day, of course, McGrath got more than he bargained for. And this is actually very similar. I'll jump ahead just a little bit in the history here. It's very similar, actually, to what happened after Nixon fired Archibald Cox. In response to that order firing Cox, Nixon faced a ferocious public backlash. Hundreds of thousands of calls and letters streamed into the White House and both houses of Congress. And within less than a week, Nixon concluded that he had to back down and agree to the appointment of another special prosecutor.
So I'm actually going to skip over Watergate And I'm going to skip over the entire independent counsel period, which are histories that are pretty well known, in order to pose to you the four questions with which you've titled the last four chapters of the book, which the second half of the book kind of turns to these questions that everybody has at the front of their minds. You've kind of done a chapter on each of them. So let's just talk through those. Can the president be charged with a crime? There's a active debate about this in the legal academy and in the political world, and it's a matter about which the Justice Department has a longstanding opinion. What's your view?
I think that there are reasonable constitutional arguments on both sides. The question of whether a sitting president can be charged with a crime while he remains in office is one that the Constitution, as you know, does not directly speak to. The closest it comes to directly addressing this question is in the impeachment clause, which provides that federal officials subject to impeachment and removal is subject to indictment after leaving office. And some constitutional scholars, of course, have read this text as implying that impeachment is the only mechanism for removing a sitting president from office. The problem with that argument is that it proves too much. It's not just presidents who are subject to impeachment and removal. A whole range of federal officials, most notably including federal judges, are also subject to impeachment and removal. And several federal judges have been charged with crimes before they have been impeached and removed from office. Most people think that this is just fine, and there has been relatively little serious argument that this violated the constitution, any kind of constitutional prohibition on the indictment of sitting judges. So what makes the president different? It has to be something other than the text of the impeachment clause. And the argument that is usually made is that the president is unique in our constitutional system. The president is a branch of government unto himself, as William Barr put it in his now famous memo on obstruction of justice, and to permit a grand jury of randomly chosen citizens or a federal prosecutor, whether a special outside prosecutor or a regular Justice Department prosecutor, to indict a sitting president would effectively give the power to very seriously interfere with or impair the president's functioning, the president's ability to do his constitutionally assigned responsibilities to an official without any kind of accountability to the public. And that just seems to many people to be at odds with the elaborate democratic process and the high democratic threshold set up by the Constitution for removing a president from office. There's some additional practical arguments which are offered to support this view. I think the most important and the most persuasive is that removal of a president is a wrenching process, and to permit the effective removal or disabling of a president through the filing of criminal charges without the kind of democratic conversation and the kind of democratic decision-making that is involved in impeachment by a majority of the House and conviction by two-thirds of the Senate would potentially rend, if not actually rip, the political fabric of the nation. The president's supporters just might not be able to accept that result, and we might see very serious social unrest and political discord as a result. We might see that even in the aftermath of impeachment and removal, but at least impeachment and removal through the process provided by the Constitution involves democratically accountable officials making judgments.
One follow-up on this. One question I've always had about the can the president be indicted question is, does it matter? I mean, given that OLC has a view of this and that view binds Bob Mueller, does it really matter what the abstract correct answer to the amenability to indictment question is?
I think the short answer is no. In light of that policy, there is virtually no chance that special counsel Robert Mueller will indict the president, at least while he remains in office.
Next question. Can the president be compelled to testify under oath? This seems like a much liver question in an immediate sense, given that Mueller clearly has questions he wants to ask the president. If he were to file a subpoena and go to court to try to enforce it, who wins that?
I think the answer is probably yes. A president can be compelled to testify under oath. There is no clear precedent, as you know, directly addressing this question. The closest precedent is United States versus Nixon, which holds that the president can be compelled to turn over documents in an active criminal investigation. The underlying principles of U.S. versus Nixon, I think, pretty closely match and ought to control the question of whether the president can be compelled to testify under oath. But there are some salient differences between the two situations. Most notably, the president has to personally participate ordered to testify under oath. He's got to spend time preparing. He's got to show up at a particular place and time. It may or may not be in a courtroom or before a live grand jury. It might be on tape, as President Clinton was when he testified before Ken Starr's grand jury. Three prior presidents have testified under oath as part of special prosecutor investigations. Ronald Reagan after he left office, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton as part of negotiated settlements between the president's lawyers and the special prosecutor. I would have said that in most cases that would be the most likely outcome for the two sides to reach negotiated settlement. That seems less and less likely in the present case, and so we might well see some litigation over this point. Although I think both sides still do have some strong reasons to reach a negotiated settlement if they possibly can.
Everybody seems to agree that there are circumstances related to interference with witnesses or evidence in which a president can violate the obstruction of justice statutes. There is a fierce disagreement, however, about whether the president can obstruct justice through a facially valid exercise of his Article II powers. How do you understand the answer to that question?
In some ways, this is like the indictment question in that the answer doesn't really matter, since the special prosecutor is extremely unlikely to indict a president. I do think that there's a larger sense, a broader sense, in which the question does matter, because whether the House of Representatives is willing to impeach a president and whether the people are willing to support that decision, as well as the subsequent removal of the president by the Senate, I think is going to turn at least in part, and should turn at least in part, on whether the House and the people are convinced that the president has committed a crime. And I do think that the president, even when he's acting within the scope of his Article II constitutional powers, is capable of obstructing justice if he exercises those powers in a way that has the effect of or is an attempt to obstruct an ongoing federal investigation and is pursued with a corrupt intent, which is to say, in this context, with the intent of protecting himself and his friends from criminal liability, or protecting himself and his friends from damaging political fallout. Of course, there are legitimate reasons why a president who has the Article II constitutional authority to supervise the Justice Department and to supervise the FBI as part of the Justice Department might interfere with or make decisions about the progress of ongoing investigations. But I think there are clearly illegitimate ways which are not consistent with the president's oath and constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And I think that those can constitute obstruction of justice. And if they can't, then Richard Nixon didn't obstruct justice either, at least in the most famous episode, which ultimately drove him from office, which is the conversation on the smoking gun tape in which he orders his chief of staff, H.R. Bob Haldeman, to get the CIA to squash the FBI's investigation into the Watergate burglary. That clearly falls within the president's constitutional authorities under Article II to supervise the executive branch.
Finally, there's been a lot of talk in Congress about passing legislation to protect the special prosecutor. This legislation, of course, was an element of the old Ethics in Government Act, the independent counsel law, which both, as you noted earlier, limited the firing of independent counsels to circumstances of good cause and provided judicial review of those actions should they take place, which they never did. there has always been a constitutional anxiety about that, and it figures in the Supreme Court's discussion in Morrison v. Olson, as well as in Justice Scalia's famous dissent in Morrison. And there is an anxiety to this day about the constitutionality of any prospective sort of protect Mueller legislation. So can they do it? Can you protect Bob Mueller legislatively? And if so, what would a constitutional effort to do so look like?
Under existing law, the answer to that question is clear. The Supreme Court decided in Morrison versus Olson by a 7-1 vote that the Ethics in Government Act and the independent counsel it created, which was statutorily protected, insulated against easy removal by the president, was constitutional, did not unconstitutionally interfere with the president's Article II powers to supervise the executive branch, and did not violate the Appointments Clause of the Constitution. All of the proposals that have been advanced by members of the current Congress, principally in the Senate, I think are clearly constitutional under the court's decision in Morrison versus Olson. But that decision has been much criticized, and Justice Scalia's dissent in that decision has been much celebrated, especially by conservative Republicans who hold a unitary executive theory of the presidency, under which the president is entitled to exercise ultimate control over all executive powers vested in the executive branch by Article II of the Constitution, and not just by Republicans. Morrison versus Olson came under harsh criticism, as did the independent counsel statute during Kenneth Starr's investigation of Bill Clinton. Democrats thought that under the Independent Counsel Act, which Bill Clinton had proudly renewed at the beginning of his first term of office, that Ken Starr enjoyed far too much independence and that he had lost his sense of proportion and had behaved in an unaccountable fashion, had abused his powers, because under the Independent Counsel Act, he was not subject to control by anyone who was accountable to the people as the president is. So Morrison versus Olson stands in a pretty uncertain place, I would say, as a constitutional precedent. Democrats have, of course, in the past couple of years, come around to see the wisdom of the independent counsel statute in retrospect, have come around to embrace Morrison versus Olson in ways that few of them did back during the Clinton impeachment years. And a few Republicans have also come around to that. So I think the status of Morrison versus Olson and the constitutionality of any new legislative attempt to protect Robert Mueller is up in the air.
The book is Prosecuting the President. The author is Andrew Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to Andrew Cohen for coming on the show. If you haven't yet, please take a second to share the Lawfare Podcast on social media and give us a 5-star rating and review wherever you found us. You can now purchase Lawfare swag at our online store, www.thelawfarestore.com. The podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell. I was your audio engineer this week, and our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.